On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
French people has fervor. It is valiant. It's got courage. It doesn't give up. And it stands up whenever one of its children is on the ground. Those who wanted to hit France by deliberately attacking innocents are cowards that shot on an unarmed crowd. So we're not involved in a war of civilization because these murderers do not represent any civilization. We are in a war against jihadist terrorism, which threatens the whole world and not just France.
French President François Hollande speaking through an interpreter in front of the French Parliament today. Hollande said today that France is at war with ISIS. ISIS has claimed responsibility for coordinated terror attacks in Paris on Friday, attacks that killed nearly 130 people and wounded hundreds more. Dozens were killed outside restaurants, cafes, and bars. The targeted spots were in a neighborhood in Paris that's known to be one of the most mixed and most tolerant, a combination of artists, working-class Parisians, and immigrants, sort of like the East Village in Manhattan or Echo Park here in L.A., bourgeois bohemian, the 10th and 11th arrondissement. Ariane Dolfus lives a block from one of those cafes, La Bonne Bière, where at least five people died. When we spoke with Ariane earlier today, she started by talking about how her kids reacted.
My kids were a little bit nervous. For instance, my oldest son, he's 12 years old, and he asked me to come with him to the lycée, to the college, because he has to take the tube. So we went together. We went to see the bar. He wanted to have images. The kids here in Paris want to have concrete things, just to understand.
It happened late at night. Were they aware that it was happening?
No, yes. They were by their grandparents in the suburbs. So I was alone when it happened. And I think it was a good thing because the noises were terrible, really. I think, like everybody, we thought it was just a kid's place. But immediately I opened my windows and with many of my neighbors, and we asked ourselves, well, what happened? What is this? And I immediately understood that it was gunfires. I wrote a message on Facebook just to say the strange gunfires around Place de la République. And maybe 3 minutes later, someone answered me saying, yes, they are shooting the Petit Converge, which is the very first restaurant that they attacked before the Bonne Bière. But I think I heard the guns from the Bonne Bière.
So tell us today what it was like on your street and in your neighborhood.
Today, there are many, many people who came at noon for the minute of silence. And I think the first feeling is sadness. Sadness and the feeling that we don't understand why and how. It's concrete because we can see the shots on the bars. On the other side, it's still unbelievable. Really unbelievable. But no fear, I think, because this is what they want. They want us to be afraid. But I must admit that I have to look for another apartment because mine is too small, and I think I will. So this was already a plan for us. But I must say, this feeling that I will have every day, if I still stay in this area, every day I will think of it. So maybe going somewhere else would be a way to not to forget, but not to have every day these images.
Now, this is a neighborhood that people keep wondering why it was targeted, because it was such a tolerant neighborhood. It wasn't a symbol, per se, of France. It didn't have fancy restaurants. It didn't have any big symbols of French power. It was just a normal bohemian neighborhood. And so when you think about why this neighborhood was targeted, what answers do you have? What do you think?
This is the whole question we have, we had this morning. Why us? It's difficult to get answers, but I think it's exactly what you said. I think that this is a tolerant area. This is a very mixed area, very cosmopolitan. We have French people. We have people from Maghreb. We have Muslims. We have Chinese. And everybody lives very well together. And this vivre ensemble, what we say, vivre ensemble, is something that they cannot accept. And it's very interesting to see that they tried to shut restaurants where there were many, many young people. We see the photos of all the victims today in the press in Paris, and they are all under 30 years old. And the killers, the terrorists, were 20 years old. Mm-hmm. That's French. Young people killed young people.
How do you think France should react right now? What do you want from your president? What do you think he should do?
It's difficult to say what the French politicians should do. I have no idea about international policies, really. I'm not a specialist enough. But I think what we should do is to do a real social work in the suburbs, because those kids were French. Those ones who killed in Paris, they are French. So we have a real work to do to help those kind of kids so that they don't do it again. And we had this, it's the same kind of profile with the Koulibaly brothers, who were the killers of the Charlie Hebdo journalist. Mm-hmm. I should say, I don't know what we must do, what France must do abroad, but I really think we have to do real work inside.
Ariane Dolphus, a freelance culture reporter, she lives in the 11th arrondissement in Paris, where many of the attacks took place Friday night. Well, reaching out to Muslim youth in the suburbs of Paris is one thing. Many of the alleged attackers, though, grew up in Belgium, like brothers Salah and Ibrahim Abdeslam. Both are implicated in the attacks, one as a suicide bomber and one as a shooter at the Bataclan Music Hall.
Je ne sais pas vous dire pourquoi. Je ne sais pas vous dire comment. Nous sommes une famille.
That's a third brother, Mohamed Abdeslam, who had nothing to do with the attacks. He says his family is shocked that his brothers had joined ISIS. Well, the manhunt continues across both Belgium and France for Salah Abdeslam and others who may have been involved. French authorities have named a Belgian man as the mastermind of the Paris attacks. Abdelhamid Abdaoud is 27 years old and has fought with ISIS in Syria. He has also been connected to a foiled terror attack in Belgium back in January. Meanwhile, the question of what's next is playing out on the international stage. President Obama weighed in today from the G20 conference in Turkey, and he defended the way the U.S. has fought ISIS so far.
On the military front, our coalition is intensifying our airstrikes, more than 8,000 to date. We're taking out ISIL leaders, commanders, their killers. We've seen that when we have an effective partner on the ground, ISIL can and is pushed back.
The president cited the recent success in the Iraqi town of Sinjar as an example. U.S. coalition-led airstrikes enabled Kurdish forces to take back the town of Sinjar from ISIS last week.
So in short, both in Iraq and Syria, ISIL controls less territory than it did before.
For more on the reaction to the Paris terror attacks and how it might affect U.S. foreign policy, we're joined now by Aaron David Miller, a former Middle East negotiator under Republican and Democratic administrations. Welcome to you.
Pleasure to be here.
And also Yohi Driesen, managing editor for News and for at Foreign Policy Magazine. Hi, Yohi.
Hi, Madeline.
Let me start with you. French President François Hollande has said the attacks were planned in Syria, they were organized in Belgium, and they were perpetrated on French soil with French complicity. Take us through a little bit more about what we know about who planned and executed these attacks.
In some ways, I would flip the question slightly and highlight all the things that we don't yet know.
Mm-hmm.
Starting, and perhaps most importantly, we don't yet know the degree to which the Islamic State leadership in Raqqa in Syria, more specifically the self-proclaimed caliph of the Islamic State, whether they planned this, whether they knew of it, whether they sent money, whether they organized it, whether they had any kind of operational role in carrying it out, or whether they even knew about it in advance. In some ways, that's the question, because if they did, that suggests a level of organization that would basically be rivaling what Al-Qaeda did before September 11th, where Osama bin Laden knew about the attacks, had a deputy entrusted with carrying them out, which would fundamentally change the way we see the Islamic State and we see its leadership. But flowing from that question, we get down to the sort of more nitty-gritty details of, was any money necessary for carrying this out? How do they communicate? There's been a suggestion that they used some form of encrypted communication, but no details as to what that was. How do they cross borders? Why was French and Belgian intelligence and security services not picking up any rumblings this was happening? So there are a lot of the questions that are kind of key details, but above it all is that, to my mind, fundamental question of, did the leadership of the Islamic State order this directly? Were they aware of it? And how did they, and if they did know and they were aware, how did they actually transmit the orders to carry it out?
Well, so what about this alleged mastermind, Abdelhamid Abaoud, who had trained in Syria, and he is being sought after as the person who may have coordinated these attacks?
What's very interesting about him is that he is somebody that had been wanted previously by Belgian authorities for a different terror plot that had been foiled there in January, as you mentioned. In February, so a month after that foiled attack, he gave an interview to the Islamic State's magazine. It's kind of hard to say that without giggling if it wasn't so deadly serious, but to their magazine called Dabiq. And in it, he talked about how the Belgian authorities actually had him in their custody but let him go. And he says it in this sort of mocking way about how they had me and these fools had me but let me go because they looked at a photo, they looked at me, and they thought I wasn't the guy in the photo. And so it's fascinating when you think about it that this man had been tied to a plot that was foiled. This man was someone the Belgians actually had detained and stopped, but he got out of it. And you wonder how different the history of this horror might have been had there been even a secondary level of screening by the Belgians in February.
Yeah, and there was another man, Salah Abdeslam, one of the brothers, who was also apparently questioned at the border on Saturday and let go.
Exactly. I mean, it would be one of those horrific and very grim ironies that what may have happened with the mastermind on the Belgian side may also have happened with, I'm not sure if we want to call him the mastermind, but certainly someone who is intimately involved. Again, that they had reason to suspect him, they had stopped him, but then they let him go. And the questions that the French security services will be facing in the months ahead will be lacerating in terms of the criticism.
Mm-hmm.
One, how'd you not pick up chatter of this? Two, if there was Islamic State orders or money, how could you not have stopped it? And then three, if you had this guy stopped and if you had the ringleader stopped on the Belgian side, how on earth did he get out?
All right, Aaron David Miller, I want to bring you in on this. And I wonder if you could pick up on something that Yohi said earlier about not really knowing the degree to which this attack was planned by ISIS leadership in Syria and Iraq. And could you pick up on that to talk about whether or not this could be coordinated?
You could use the same logic about the Sharm attack.
Uh-huh.
I mean, after all, downing of a Russian commercial aircraft, and there's still no formal acknowledgement that can be validated through independent confirmation that this was an ISIS-directed attack. The real question, and Yohi wrestles with this too, I know, is in the end, is this a distinction without a difference? I mean, the reality is either by direction, inspiration, or creating aspirations for hundreds, if not thousands, of its adherents who have fought in Syria and now returning, a portion of which I suspect will also come back to the United States, whether or not it makes much of a difference. The question, it seems to me, that the policy question, which is also analytical, is this. Is this a transformative act? I hate this word, game changer,
mm-hmm.
the Paris attacks. Or is this, in fact, just another cruel and horrific turn and twist in what will prove to be the long war against terror? And I suspect, despite the heroic, completely understandable effort of a grieving France and a president who wants to demonstrate that he can protect his constituents and his countrymen and women, in essence, I suspect it's the latter. If you listen to the president in Antalya, that is to say, he has no intention of fundamentally altering the main focus of American policy. And if you look to others, France is probably not going to invoke Article 5 of the NATO treaty. Attack on one is an attack on all, which might turn over to NATO operational planning, conception, training, and the execution of a comprehensive military strategy, including boots on the ground. Nobody, not the United States, not the former Soviet Union, Russia, certainly not the Arabs, is prepared, it seems to me, to deploy thousands of ground forces in an effort, forget constraining or ultimately degrading or defeating ISIS, but to eradicating it. I'm not arguing that that is the wisest policy. What I'm arguing is that what we're going to see in the wake of Paris is no determinative or conclusive, let alone comprehensive solution to the problem that we face. And the administration doesn't even want to acknowledge and recognize it for what it is. The president continues to talk about violence and extremism, heinous acts. All of this is true. But the reality is we face, without engaging in any political rhetoric or exaggeration, however decentralized and atomized it's become, a global jihadi network that is, in essence, determined to spread its poison and terror. And I suspect that we will be faced with this. This is the greatest foreign policy challenge of my children's generation. And frankly, whether or not we're willing to face up to it, whether the international community is prepared to shoulder its responsibilities, I'm not even sure what that means, some sort of collective action, the marshaling of Arab states and the major great powers for a concerted campaign, not just to eradicate ISIS, but to deal with the day after problem. We've seen this movie before. It was called Iraq and Afghanistan. The endings, it seems to me, were very clear, painful, and very tragic. But we're left, last point, we're left really in the middle, I think, with a kind of a Goldilocks strategy, a kind of not too hot, not too cold strategy. And this virtually ensures that the long war, and it will be a long war, is going to continue.
Okay, we're going to take a break right there. I want you guys to stick around, and we'll talk about more of that, our strategies going forward in confronting this global jihadi network, as Aaron David Miller calls it, and also what's going to happen with the Syrian refugees. We'll talk about all that in just a moment after this.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I'm speaking with Yohi Driesen, Managing Editor for News at Foreign Policy Magazine, and Aaron David Miller at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Yohi, I want you to pick up on what Aaron David Miller said earlier about confronting this global jihadi network and how this is going to be a fight that will last perhaps many more decades. What do you think about that? And what do you think about the United States' tactics with regards to what's happening in Syria and Iraq, this kind of Goldilocks strategy that Aaron David Miller described? Is there a different strategy that is being contemplated that could work?
I think the only strategy that could shift it, but as Aaron points out, and I agree, the cost would be astronomically high and difficult to predict, would be some form of ground presence, whether it was American, whether it was Arab, whether it was European, whether it was some combination of all three, working alongside the Kurds and alongside whatever Iraqi or Syrian militias or security forces could be rebuilt. Absent that, prior to this attack, if you'd given, I think, sodium pentothal to President Obama and his aides, they would have said fairly openly that the goal was to contain ISIS. Publicly, they've always said their goal was to degrade and ultimately destroy. That was the phrase they used. But in truth, the goal was to contain, to try to prevent it from expanding beyond the borders, but basically to accept in a fundamental way that they would continue to be where they were. That now has changed. I mean, what we've seen first in Russia, then in the bombings in Beirut, which got very little attention, certainly compared to the Paris attacks, is a very aggressive ISIS, a very muscular ISIS, one that cannot be contained. The complication, the real complication to my mind, isn't simply how many people they have. It isn't simply the amount of foreign passports they have. It's that they're morphing, as Al-Qaeda did before them, from a physical group in a physical place to an idea. Mm. And once a group becomes an idea, defeating it becomes virtually impossible.
So picking up on that, Aaron David Miller, that would fall to our intelligence services, and that this would be more of a battle on that score. CIA Chief John Brennan today criticized the recent rollback of surveillance in the wake of Edward Snowden's revelations. Do you think that this will lead to an increase in domestic surveillance?
It's a fascinating question. 14 years after 9/11, there's not been a single successful attack against the continental United States directed by a foreign terrorist organization. Now, why is that? Is that because of the preemptive preventative actions taken by both this president's Republican predecessor, at least in the wake of 9/11, and this president? Is that because our intelligence capacities and capabilities have improved? Is it because of the two liquid assets, our liquid assets, the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean, which prevent a much more difficult, much more insurmountable boundaries for easy terrorist access to the United States? Is it the fact that the Canadians and the Mexicans, in part, are non-predatory and that we do have, despite a lot of comments to the contrary, a reasonable border protection and security? Is it because we're just lucky? I don't know the answer to that question. But I suspect, given the FBI suspicions that you already have in this country, hundreds if not thousands of social media sympathizers, and let's distinguish between what goes on in Twitter and social media and Facebook from the actual planning, operational planning that went into this particular operation. Six of the eight or maybe more of these perpetrators had some exposure or presence, I think, in Syria proper. So I think the answer is yes, you're going to have a degree of vigilance and hyper-vigilance. And I think there's a really good article today in the New York Times by one of my former colleagues, Stephen Simon and Daniel Byman, about why Paris, Washington isn't Paris, and why the United States is not Europe. And their collective point at the end is, rather than contributing military might, what we can do with all the bells and whistles that we have at our disposal on the technology side, make a huge contribution in the realm of intelligence, mm-hmm. Both providing this intelligence to our allies and using it ourselves to preempt and certainly prevent future attacks. I thought that Ben Rhodes's comment yesterday, indicating that ISIS had the intentions but not the, I think he used the word, great capability strike the United States, was very unfortunate, because I think we've consistently, and Yochi made a brilliant point, I thought, from an organization which now has which had an address to the organizational embodiment of an idea, this idea of global jihad, which is going to spread. I think that's, in the end, the problem we face, and that's why this really is the long war.
And why wouldn't that idea then spread to the United States and become embedded here in the United States, Yohi?
I think in some ways what the real fear, when you drill down a little bit, there had been this comforting idea, I think, that you could break terrorism down into two varieties. One, the very scary lone wolf variety, the idea that someone sitting at their computer could be radicalized based on what they're seeing, decide to pick up a knife or a gun and carry out an attack, which would be virtually impossible to predict because this is not someone necessarily talking to anyone else. Or the kind of 9/11 model where terrorists were actually sent from one place to the United States to carry out an attack. It's very possible that what we're seeing in Paris is a third model, a sort of hybrid model in which one person, maybe two, was actually dispatched by the Islamic State, but that the people who he then linked up with, the ones who carried out the attacks, were to a degree people who had become sort of self-radicalized lone wolves. And so you're taking the scariest of the one model, the idea of people who radicalize may not be detectable, the scariest of the other, the notion of a terrorist being able to travel relatively easily from a terror area to a civilized area, and pairing them together. And the combination of those two things would be new and very scary.
All right, let's talk about what's going to happen with the Syrian refugees. Here in the U.S., some Republicans are now saying only Christian refugees from Syria should be allowed in. I believe Jeb Bush said that, as well as Ted Cruz. And at last count, 12 Republican governors from the states of Illinois, Ohio, Florida, North Carolina, New Hampshire, Arizona, Indiana, Massachusetts, Louisiana, Michigan, Alabama, Texas, and Arkansas, and one Democrat, the governor of New Hampshire, have all said that they will not accept any Syrian refugees. How do you see the politics of this plan out domestically, Aaron David Miller?
Badly. I mean, the tension between our values and our security, our civil liberties and the capacity to make us feel secure and be secure, I think is going to be tested in a presidential election year. It will not be tested according to the standards of rationality and logic. I don't think, frankly, that, I think the administration will try to rise to the occasion. I'm not confident enough in our vetting processes to basically assume that, regardless of how comprehensive we are, that we may not be faced with a percentage of individuals who manage. Certainly the Europeans Europe has already demonstrated the fact that they cannot hermetically seal their borders against a few or perhaps even a significant minority. In with the vast majority of refugees and migrants who are fleeing, the very scourge that was represented in Paris over the weekend. I don't know how this is going to play out. I'm hoping that we'll find that balance. But again, in a year like this, when political rhetoric, particularly on the part of outsider candidates who understand the positive impact and bump that they get from making these sorts of statements, particularly on the issue of immigration, I can't be sure that we will, in fact, rise to the occasion.
Well, not only outsider, Marco Rubio says we should not accept any refugees because we can't really, as you say, vouch for our background checks when you're trying to check someone in Syria. And what about in Europe, Yohi Driessen, and the idea that perhaps borders might be closed, that might affect the Schengen agreement?
Yeah, the Schengen zone was one of the real accomplishments of post-war Europe, and it is kind of a miraculous thing in some ways when we think about a Europe that had been at war for centuries, where borders were arbitrarily drawn, there'd be bloody wars over those borders, and then new ones would be drawn. The idea that you could have a Europe free of borders, where someone could just travel easily from one place to another, was really legitimately historic. And I think you've begun to see it be chipped away, that idea sort of fall bit by bit over the last few years, frankly, first over the economy, with fears that you might have workers from Poland, let's say, willing to accept small amounts of money, go to Germany and take German jobs, a kind of argument you hear, like in the U.S., when it comes to the notion of Mexicans taking American jobs. And now, because of security, you've already seen countries like Hungary, Slovenia, put up literal fences, on their borders, put up other obstacles short of fencing. So you've begun to see, at the outskirts of Europe, some of the EU nations that weren't as core to the EU as France began to build fencing. The idea that you're now seeing France, the country that perhaps more than any other embodied the optimism of the EU, closing its borders, talking about putting new border restrictions in, possibly permanently, is, when you think about what France has been, the role that it played in creating the EU, if it were to permanently seal itself off in any way, that would be a historic blow to what had been a historic accomplishment.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us today. Yohi Driessen, Managing Editor for News at Foreign Policy Magazine, and Aaron David Miller, Vice President and Distinguished Scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Thank you both.
Thanks, Madeline.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, we'll meet a man who works part-time at the Paris Opera Ballet. He's world-renowned choreographer William Forsythe. He has another job, teaching dance to undergrads at USC.
What Los Angeles has going for it is it doesn't have a big, stiff tradition.
William Forsythe's radical take on ballet after this news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, turning to a different kind of story about one of our many connections to France. William Forsythe is one of the world's most renowned choreographers. His choreography is based in ballet, but not traditional tutus and classical music ballet. His work is contemporary, edgy, and sometimes politically charged. This year, at age 66, William Forsythe left the company he founded in Germany 10 years ago, but he's still creating work around the world for the Paris Opera Ballet and right here in Los Angeles. For 2 months each year, he'll teach undergrads at the brand new Gloria Kaufman School of Dance at USC.
Fiction. Do any of you know China Mieville? Oh.
I caught up with William Forsythe at USC recently before the attacks in Paris. Here's our conversation, beginning with his very unusual background.
I started as a club dancer. So, and I had a fake ID, you know, fake license, and I was 15, and I was in there, and I was trying to get up on the stage, you know, because you had to be really good to get up on stage. And then I had a brief stint as a stripper. I did musicals. I actually wanted to go into musical theater. I didn't even know what ballet was. I had absolutely no idea whatsoever, none. And then my roommate in college said he was taking ballet, and I said, oh, I have to see this. And I went to the class, and I said the classic line, oh, I can do that. And sure enough, I could. So 3 years later, I was in Joffrey Ballet.
So how long have you been in L.A. now?
Well, I've been in and out of L.A. I'm going to be here a total of 8 weeks this school year. This is now my fourth week. I particularly like being in L.A. I've been living in deepest, darkest Germany for a long time, for the past 45 years. So I find it incredibly refreshing to encounter another culture. I'm more or less a European. I was 23 when I moved.
From New York?
From New York, yeah. I was 23, and 45 years later, I decided to move back. So I feel like a foreigner. I spent 45 years feeling like a foreigner, and now I feel like a foreigner again, which is very interesting.
You don't feel like an American?
Jein, as the Germans would say.
What does that mean?
That's a combination of ja and nein. It's like, Perhaps it's just campus culture. Campus culture, which is basically where I am the most, is a very specific American phenomena, I find. There's a kind of rallying around certain things that are somewhat superficial on some level. And in the other sense, there's a kind of pride in certain things. I don't relate to, for example, football.
But football, okay. There is something graceful about football when it's played well. You're shaking your head. Well, something. Is there anything to compare football and dance? And do they have anything in common?
I really like the training they go through. That could easily cross over to dance and be of tremendous benefit. I did hire a strength and agility trainer who was a sports scientist in Germany to begin to train our dancers that way. And that's why I'm familiar with this. And I myself, even at the ripe old age of 66, do a lot of deadlifts. And it doesn't make you bulky, which is what majority of ballet dancers are afraid of.
So you'll be here for 8 weeks out of the year, and you'll be teaching undergraduates.
Mm-hmm.
So what is that like? You have spent many, many decades with your own company and trained dancers who know your style and they know what you like and they know what to do when you ask them to do something.
Mm. I've been working exclusively with professionals for the last 45 years. The students are from all over. They're from South America. They're from Canada. They're from all over the United States. They're all different shapes and sizes. They have all different kinds of skills and interests. It's just a very diverse group. And this is a really exciting challenge because I have to explain things very, very carefully and very well. I have to adapt to a very diverse skill set in the room. I have dancers, for example, who are very good at hip-hop, but have no ballet. And the opposite of that, ballet dancers who have never moved in a hip-hop way. And so I have to find common ground, and I also have to find a reason for myself to be in the room. Or how could I be of any value to these people who are 17 years old? Do I have anything of relevance to say to them? Any way I could be helpful to them? Could I imagine their futures and imagine perhaps what kind of skills they might need? I'm discussing often what is the nature of leadership. You never know where you might end up. The person who runs this program, Jody Gates, was dancing for me when she was 17 years old. And now she's my boss.
Are you still choreographing?
Yes, I am. Well, every class is choreography. There's no difference. There's no difference between working for professionals or the person standing in front of you. I don't think I do any less, or I don't demand any less from myself.
But you're also working for Paris Opera Ballet.
I am working for Paris Opera Ballet. I'm making work there.
And what does that entail? When do you start working on it?
Well, I started working on it 3 years ago. Oh. It's with the musician James Blake. He's a wonderful young English musician. And I'm really interested in his compositions. I think that they're compositionally very beautiful works of art. And I'm very excited to be working with that music. Yeah.
How do you see yourself in the United States? How do you see your reputation as a choreographer?
You know, for years, the Americans were calling me the European/German choreographer, and the Europeans were calling me the American choreographer. So I think I'm sort of mid-Atlantic. It's interesting. At one point, we were having issues doing tours in America because people said it's too controversial or it's too... I hate the term, but they said too cutting edge or too advanced for our audience. So this sort of goes against my motto, which I adopted from Richard Serra, the sculptor, who said, I always assume my audience is more intelligent than I am. I think I'm now not so scary from a lot of American companies. I think I'm working with about 12 different American companies right now. Actually, I think the ubiquity of dance now through YouTube, for example, or media in general, is making a generation of very sophisticated viewers. And I think that many people are underestimating, I think in the critical establishment, they are underestimating how skilled people actually are at reading motion.
What do you think of So You Think You Can Dance?
The performers are amazing. I think that they give every molecule of their being to that event. The event itself is another thing. It's a commercial event, but it does allow you to see people in that state of attention. No one veers for a microsecond in that, and that's why we like it. We go to see people actually be in that state. I'm not a snob. I like it all. I think to discriminate between forms is really a mistake. It doesn't matter what the material is. Yeah.
And so why aren't you teaching this in another city? Why did you come to Los Angeles?
I came because the department is completely new. There is no precedent here. There's no way of doing things. Things haven't been done this way over the last, we've done it for the last 30 years. It's just from the ground up, and I'm allowed to think. What Los Angeles has going for it is it doesn't have a big, stiff tradition. That's the usual hype. It's got to be a big ballet company, as if. Oh, really? Do you think the world's going that way? Do you think everything's gravitating towards larger, bigger, better ballet companies? I don't think so. I think to make an assumption that art only comes from one place is just dangerous. Yeah. As if we really know where art could come from and what its source might be. Yeah. So I think that good dancing is good dancing. I don't care what kind it is. And the first thing I said to the dancers is never, ever discriminate between forms. There are so many smart people here. People who are, for example, animators. Animators are really interested in motion. They want to know how the world works. Yeah. So I think there's a very receptive community here. We just have to tap them. But certainly, I would imagine more than any place in the world, there are people who would really be receptive to sophisticated physical discourses.
All right. Well, thank you so much. That was really fun.
Good. It's a pleasure.
That was William Forsyth, the choreographer and professor at USC's new Gloria Kaufman School of Dance. Okay, Warren Olney is here now to give us a preview of what's happening at 1 o'clock, and I imagine you will be talking about Paris.
We are going to be diving deeply into the aftermath of that situation, starting with the announcement today by the head of the CIA that it was all planned in advance, that it was, in fact, attributable to ISIS, although I think there's still probably some uncertainty about that in some quarters. Then we'll talk a bit about what's happening in Paris itself and what the implications are for the civil rights of Parisians, because they're conducting a lot of warrantless searches right now. The president, Hollande, is very much under pressure. He's got an election coming up in 3 weeks. And Marie Le Pen, who seems to be leading in the polls, very conservative right-wing candidate, is attacking him for not having done enough. So he's trying to do more. And we'll talk a bit, too, about the attacks themselves, where they came from, and, you know, what might be done. We'll hear a lot from President Obama.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's interesting. He came out very forcefully against some of what the Republicans are saying in terms of the Syrian refugees.
Not just the Republicans, but others as well. Mm-hmm. That's right. Several governors have said they don't want to have Syrian refugees. He was quite impassioned about that, much more so, according to one of the people we talked to, than he was about the attacks in Paris and what ought to be done about them. He seemed to be sort of resigned to being attacked for not doing enough and said, you know, everybody who makes a suggestion suggests we're doing that we do what we're already doing. So he'd rather talk about the refugees.
Right, right. And 10,000, I think, that he wants to accept here in the United States. Well, we'll see. We'll see whether Paul Ryan will allow funding for that.
Good question.
Okay. So lots of questions, a few answers perhaps in the next hour on To the Point with Warren Olney. Thank you.
Okay.
And coming up on this show, the band that was playing in Paris at the Bataclan Club the night of the attacks is from here, from Palm Desert. We're going to find out more about the Eagles of Death Metal next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Hundreds of people gathered at Cal State Long Beach yesterday to remember design student Noemi Gonzalez.
We now have an angel watching out for us. Don't let the pain allow you to forget about her.
She was a young woman living a dream, dining in a Paris bistro on a semester abroad when she was gunned down in Friday's terrorist attacks. Another connection to Southern California, the band playing at the Bataclan Concert Hall when the terrorists attacked. Perhaps 100 people were killed there at that sold-out concert. The band escaped unscathed, but their merchandising manager, Nick Alexander, was killed. Despite their name, the Eagles of Death Metal do not play death metal. In fact, their blues rock tunes like Wannabe in L.A. can be heard occasionally right here on KCRW.
I came to L.A. to make rock and roll. Along the way, I had to sell my soul. I made some good friends that make me say, I really want to be in L.A.
Lead singer Jesse Hughes spent his formative years in Palm Desert. Guitarist Dave Catching owns a recording studio in the desert, and they played regularly at Pappy and Harriet's, a roadhouse and restaurant in nearby Pioneer Town. Robin Celia is co-owner of Pappy and Harriet's, and she's here now to tell us more about the band, Eagles of Death Metal. Thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
Well, have you talked to Dave or Jesse or anyone in the band? Or
I haven't talked to anyone in the band. It's all through mutual friends and people, you know, neighbors out here in the desert. And, you know, we just, literally at 2:30, I got an email from one of our mutual friends that just said, I'm praying for the guys. And my initial thought was, oh, my God, did my kitchen blow up? Like, I had no idea what was, like, did something happen at Pappy's? And then I pulled over in my car and I called, and he said, you know, the Eagles of Death Metal are being taken by hostage, and, you know, in Paris. And the second phone call I got was my security guard, who was hysterically crying. I mean, it just, like, all of a sudden it hit the news. And then somehow I found out through mutual friends that the band was safe. So we all kind of were like, okay, at least we can be there.
Right. So that's some good news from that horrible, horrific evening. Do you know where they are now?
I have no idea. I don't. I believe they should be on their way home, but I'm not positive.
So tell us more about the band, what they're like. Tell us a little bit more about their music, where they came from.
You know, I mean, I've owned this bar for 12 years, and I deal with musicians on a daily basis, and you're just never going to find a more down-to-earth group of guys. They're just, I feel like they are very aware of how lucky they are and are able to do what they do and what they love to do and make a living, and they're just, they don't take themselves seriously. They just bring joy to people. I know that Joshua and Jesse were best friends growing up in the desert, and from what I understand, it's like Jesse was just kind of doing his thing, and Josh, they got together and started the band.
Mm.
But it's been like revolving members. Like, you know, there's been a they've played at the club with all different kinds of members. And my staff loves them. You know, we've known them for 12 years.
Yeah. And so they, Eagles of Death Metal, I mean, people probably thought, oh, death metal, that's why they were targeted. But they don't play death metal.
In fact,
right? The name is kind of a joke.
I know. It's a joke. And they're like the ultimate party band. Do you know what I mean? It's like you're never going to walk away from an Eagles of Death Metal show and think like, well, that was okay. You know, it's always going to be an amazing show and a great time. And people are just so happy. I mean, the biggest show we have ever had was the guitar player Dave Ketching had his birthday party at the club. And it was an outside show. And Eagles of Death Metal played with Peaches. And it was sold out. But then there was like 400 names on the guest list that we had to deal with. So it was like, you know, that just shows you how you know, well-loved these guys are. And it was one of the best shows we ever had. And, you know, again, like not one problem.
Yeah. Well, so how do they represent the kind of spirit or ethos of the desert?
Well, I mean, you know, the desert isn't the easiest place to live. So I feel like there is this, like, kind of common bond with all of us who live out here. And they're just like the biggest kind of like group of kids in a way, you know, they have their cars and their dirt bikes and their music, and they love to cook for you. And, you know, they have these great parties at the Rancho, the recording studio. They're just, you know, it is this kind of like, just, they're just really great guys.
Yeah. So I wonder how they must be feeling now. I mean,
I just think, you know, that they're going to need their privacy and wrap their heads around what just happened to them. I can't imagine.
Yeah. So another member of the band, kind of on again, off again member, is Josh Homme, who is with Queens of the Stone Age. He wasn't there, was he, in Paris?
He wasn't there, no.
Yeah.
I think he tours occasionally with them.
Right.
And,
so,
you know, he's obviously like, you know, Josh, he is the desert to me. Do you know what I mean? And it's like he's been really kind to us as well, including us in the Anthony Bourdain No Reservations show about the desert. They really try to help everybody else out,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah. Well, tell us about Jesse Hughes, the lead singer. He sounds like quite a character.
Jesse's crazy. He's amazing. You know, I mean, he's kind of in and out of our lives. He pops in here and there. When the band plays, you know, we always have a great time with him. I can't imagine what they're going through right now.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
No problem. Thank you.
That's Robin Celia, co-owner of Pappy and Harriet's. And this is one of the songs off the latest Eagles of Death Metal album. It's called Save a Prayer, originally a Duran Duran song. Fans have launched an online campaign to push this song to the top of the UK singles chart in order to, quote, show solidarity against terrorists and support for peace. And that is Jolie Myers' theme song that we're hearing right here.
That's
Hi, Jolie.
Right. That's right. But that song was pretty great just now.
It's a really great song. I love their music.
You know, it's given me a new appreciation for the Eagles of Death mm-hmm. Metal, called to my attention how much I loved them when I first heard them, and how much I want to listen to them now, even
and
if
I
it's just
love
a
to
small
see
sign
them.
Of solidarity.
So I was watching some clips, and they look like a really fun band.
I mean, that's
to see
right,
live.
The Pappy and Harriet's owner there saying mm-hmm. that it's always a party. That becomes immediately clear when you listen to the music. And, you know, our listeners wanted to send positive thoughts to the Eagles of Death Metal, to the family of the woman from Long Beach who was killed, to the people in Paris. David Reinwald tweeted that the attacks on Friday broke his heart. He says that we here in Los Angeles stand with Parisians and that we're sending you all of the love and hope in the world. Stu Holland on Facebook wanted to send well wishes to the Eagles of Death Metal. He says he can't imagine what it must be like to have this happen at your concert. Heal well, Eagles of Death Metal. And Rebecca Ruvalcaba says that the healing right now will be mostly physical for victims of the attacks who survived. But these people will need so much mental healing as well. Rebecca is sending positive thoughts to the victims and their families. We had a lot of people weigh in with more political messages as well, not purely just positive thoughts for the victims of what happened in Paris. Davis Jones says that if there's one thing that could be considered positive here, and this is a stretch, but at least the world has one more reason to turn against ISIS. It's time to wipe these guys off the face of the planet, which is definitely what we're hearing from François Hollande, the president of France today, saying that France is at war. If you want to send your positive thoughts, you can tweet us at KCRW Press Play, or you can weigh in on Facebook, KCRW Press Play.
All right. Thank you very much, Jolie Myers. We'll have a lot more on Paris, the aftermath, the reaction in the next hour of To the Point with Warren Olney. So keep it right here on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.